I would like to begin by talking about the recent Earth at Risk conference, which was held, I believe, in Berkeley, California, during mid-November. You had a lot of very interesting folks attending this conference, folks such as Eric McBay, Lier Keith, folks we've talked about on the show before, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, yourself, and many more. Can you speak about the motivation to conduct such a conference?
Yeah, the motivation for having that conference, there's two sets of motivations. One of them is that most of the conferences or most of the gatherings or whatever we want to call them having to do with environmentalism have to do with environmentalism, sort of, have to do actually more with green capitalism, and they don't have much to do, or they don't have anything to do with resistance. Years ago, I was asked to speak at, I've given one talk at a Green Fest, and I've given one talk at Bioneers, and they were both pretty disappointing. With the Green Fest, the first thing I said when I got onto my stage was, you know, I look around here, and I see a lot of really groovy hemp shampoos, and I see a lot of nice soap, and I see a lot of all sorts of organic things, but actually I don't see a single thing that will help the salmon. And that's pretty much my feeling about those. They're very much, we'll go to Bioneers next. Which I did one talk at Bioneers, and I wrote an essay about this later, that it just broke my heart because, you know, those things are supposed to be pretty inspiring, but I left feeling disappointed, demoralized, and lied to. And the reason for this is because, so far as I know, I was the only person there who was talking about either power or psychopathology. And I don't know how you can talk about social change without talking about power, because social change has to do with changing power relations. And, you know, abolition has to do with changing the slave owner, chattel slave power relation, among other things. And the movement for women's suffrage was about changing the power relations there. The Tahrir Square is all about changing power relations. It makes no sense to me to not talk about power, to try to talk about social change without talking about power. And it also makes no sense to me to talk about the murder of the planet without talking about psychopathology, because power, this culture's drive for power is insatiable and psychopathological, and nobody there was talking about that. It's just this absolutely surreal experience. And it's like this last year, one of the quotes, the tag phrases, taglines for Bioneers was, the shift is hitting the fan. And it's like, you know, or it's like just a couple days ago, I got an email where somebody quoted the line by Gary Snyder. And Gary Snyder is saying how the only hope for any sort of transformation is a spiritual and religious transformation where the entire culture suddenly gets religion and begins to love the natural world. And this made me so angry that I'm going to write my next Orion column about it, because I'm just so tired. It's such a position of privilege. You know, it makes me think, okay, so if Ted Bundy had kidnapped members of Gary Snyder's family, and if they kidnapped him and they were torturing them, would he say that the only hope is for some sort of spiritual transformation on the part of the perpetrators? It's like, no, what you need to do is you need to stop the perpetrators. That's what you need to do. And then we'll worry about some sort of transformation. But the first thing you have to do is stop the perpetrators. And anybody whose primary loyalty is to the victims of some oppressive power situation, anybody whose primary loyalty is to the victims there is going to understand this, that the first thing you need to do is to stop the perps. And so I just find that incredibly frustrating. That sort of attitude is just, it's all this obsessive optimism. And I think that optimism can be I mean, if it's a lie, then it is really harmful. If optimism is true, then it's a good thing. But if I think that being optimistic as the world's being murdered is insane. So the on one level, so we have sort of a negative and a positive motivation for doing Earth at Risk. And the negative motivation was we wanted to do something, to have a conference that was better, that was not one of those. And the positive one, the positive motivation, is we wanted to have a conference that was all about resistance. Basically, a conference where everybody there is talking about what it will take to stop this culture from killing the planet. A conference where all the people are talking, where the things said by the people there are commensurate with the risks we face and are taking really hard looks and are just as honest as we can possibly be about the situation that we face. There is this great line by Andrea Dworkin that I think about so often. That is, here it is. It's, those of us who love reading and writing believe that being a writer is a sacred trust. It means telling the truth. It means being incorruptible. It means not being afraid and never lying. And so we wanted to have a conference where all the people there were telling the truth. And so we had Lear Keith talking about the relationship between agriculture and the destruction of the planet, and how how sustainable agriculture is an oxymoron. And then she moves from there to talking about masculinity within patriarchy, not biological maleness, but instead masculinity within patriarchy, and it's imperative to violate. And then talks about resistance movements, successful resistance movements, talks about the importance, how you build a resistance movement, the difference between a liberal and radical, great stuff. Stephanie McMillan came on, and she talked about how, oh, it was so great. I love this. Her opening slide, Stephanie's opening slide, was a picture of a case that has, inside it has a shotgun. And the caption is, "In case of capitalism, break glass." And so she talks about how capitalism is systematically, functionally not reformable, and how it's, you know, requires growth, how it requires exploitation of workers, requires exploitation of the natural world, and it is functional and systematic. It cannot change. Thomas Lindsay came on and talked about have you interviewed Thomas Lindsay?
I haven't, no, and I've wanted to, actually. That's someone else that's on my list.
He's great. So what one of the things he does, you've heard, I'm sure, about the various townships that are working to ban fracking, for example, or ban corporate hog farms from moving in. A community will approach Lindsay and his organization and say, you know, we want to have control over our community economic base, and so we want to keep big box stores out, big corporate hog farms, fracking, whatever. And so he will come in and help them draft ordinances that will outlaw those things, so they can have actual communal decision making processes. And it's great, because one of the things that he's about is, I mean, he does this, he's tireless, he's wonderful. And one of the things he's about is that I've asked him before, so if you know, that there's a commerce clause in the U.S. Constitution, and so why do you go into the, which says that the state, the state and the feds, especially the feds, are the ones who control commerce, and so a township cannot control commerce in that way. And so all these local democratic self-governance ordinances he's helping to pass are going to be ruled unconstitutional. So I said, why are you doing this work if it's all going to be ruled unconstitutional anyway? And he says, because when people come to me, they still believe we live in a democracy, and they believe that a community should have control over their economic situation. And they don't quite yet oftentimes fully believe that we don't live in a democracy. And so they pass these ordinances, the state comes in and squashes them, or the feds come in and squash them, and that's how you really build a revolutionary cadre, is by having people who believe the system still works try it and then find out that the system is set up to protect the corporations. And then Chris Hedges was not able to make it because he was really sick. Eric McBay came on and talked about what will happen if we don't resist. You know, basically the world's dead. And what will happen if we have sort of minimal resistance? And then what would a serious resistance look like? And he looks at historical resistance movements. You know, what were some of the things that made it so the French resistance really caught hold? And what were some of the tactics, not just tactics, but what were some of the security measures used by the French resistance or other resistance movements? And then talk about something that in Deep Green Resistance we call decisive ecological warfare, which is working for working to take down the industrial infrastructure that's killing the planet. Then the next person was my Dakota friend, Wazia Tawin, who is this great scholar and activist, talking about the the importance of indigenous resistance to not only their own survival, but to everyone's survival, and also the relation between, I mean, it's really hard because there are a lot of indigenous people who are really seriously ready to resist, but as a white person myself, it's really important that I and all of us white people not continue to put the poor and the indigenous and people of color on the front lines of fighting against capitalism. You know, I mean, of course, there are still Black Panthers who are imprisoned from the 1960s and 70s, and they were on the front lines of this fight. And they, you know, this is something that white people have done too often, and that's something we really need to. We had a conversation partly about that, about a bunch of other things too. And then the final person was Arundhati Roy talking about the importance of resistance and the state of resistance. She's done a lot of really good work with a lot of separatist and insurgent groups in India. I shouldn't say with, but describing them and describing their struggle and describing the state repression against them. And so it was really an attempt to have a conference where there would be no dead time and where it's really a serious attempt to jumpstart a resistance movement that means it.
Well, a couple things I wanted to touch on. One, I just finished her book, Walking with the Comrades, where she spends...
That's my favorite book of hers. I love that book.
Where she spends time with these groups. And it's, I mean, I blew through it in about 2 days, just picking it up and then putting it down and then walking away and having to pick it up again and thinking about it. It's a powerful book. It's a book I'm going to pass on to a lot of folks that I care about. The second part, though, I'm also interested in what reaction or feedback did you receive from the crowd? Were they engaged, responsive, and so on?
It was fantastic. Every single person received completely non-obligatory standing ovations. Enthusiastic is I guess the word I'm looking for. It was fabulous. And there were also, I think the final total was about 4,000 people watching online live stream.
Oh, great.
And about maybe 700 people there, 600 people, something like that. And the response, and this is people sitting for basically, we went from, I don't know, 10 in the morning till 7 at night or something. It was a long, long day. And, you know, all those subjects I just said, I mean, there was a break for lunch, but I mean, there was no downtime, and the response was incredibly enthusiastic. So in terms of that response, yeah. But gosh, it's been a whole 6 weeks and it hasn't sparked a resistance movement yet. You know, we haven't defeated capitalism. So I guess it was a failure.
No. I do want to tie this conversation into a broader discussion about resistance and the question of violence versus nonviolence. To be honest, now that I'm looking at the question, I don't want to word or phrase that in a dichotomous fashion either. Cause we've talked about this in the past where you had made the point that it is much more important for folks to simply resist at any level of resistance, for the time being and for folks to simply be engaged, and to get engaged. But the 15th premise of your 2-volume work, Endgame, states, love does not imply pacifism. When did you first start seriously questioning the distinction between nonviolent civil disobedience and other more militant forms of resistance? Was this an internal process that took time developing, or were you prepared for escalated forms of resistance from the beginning of your time as an activist?
That's a great question. And I think, so stop me if this is something I said the last time we talked, but when I first started talking about resistance, about militant resistance to the oppression of the oppressiveness of capitalism, of civilization, of the dominant culture, patriarchy, however, you know, wherever we want to put it, the response by audiences was pretty predictable, that which is a lot of sort of white peace and social justice activists or mainstream environmentalists would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they say the names Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Dalai Lama again and again as fast as they can to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And the response by other groups was pretty different, but a lot of people of color, a lot of survivors of domestic violence, a lot of American Indians, a lot of gang kids, a lot of prisoners, a lot of family farmers would look at me like, tell us something we don't know, let's go, bro. And it took me a little while to realize that the difference is for those latter groups, violence is not some abstract, spiritual, theological question to be puzzled through, but instead it's just part of life, and you deal with it. And it doesn't mean you participate, doesn't mean you don't, but you don't make it something it's not, and you do what needs to be done. And there's, excuse me, we were just talking a moment ago about the Arundhati Roy's newest book, and she has this line that I just love, which is, she was talking about this series of meetings with members of various separatist organizations in India, and there's this delightful quote, everybody had graduated long ago from equating the structural violence of the state with the violence of the armed resistance. I'll say it again. Everybody had graduated long ago from equating the structural violence of the state with the violence of the armed resistance. And so I bring all this up as sort of we'll get to the Arundhati Roy thing in a minute if you want. But to go back a second to those different groups, you know, I realized really early on that, I realized very early on that you can't argue with someone who is insane. And there's, and you can't really argue with someone. There's a great line by Upton Sinclair. It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would extend that to, it's hard to make someone understand something when their privilege or their economic system or whatever depends on them not understanding it, their entitlement. And so there's a point. I mean, plus I read military history starting when I was very, very young. You know, like in third and fourth grade, I'm reading all sorts of books about the American Civil War. And I've done a lot of work on racism, a lot of work on sexism, on rape culture, and I was doing a talk not very long ago, and I don't know how many people were there, maybe 150 or something. And we started talking about somebody asked something about, you know, what about violence to human beings? Isn't that just terrible? And I said, okay, let's just stop for a second. And is there anyone in this room who feels it would not have been, it was not acceptable to put Ted Bundy in prison? So we're not even talking about killing him. Okay, we're just going to talk about putting him in prison. Is it acceptable to put Ted Bundy in prison? And everybody in the room agreed. And if anybody wouldn't have, you know, then we would have had, everybody else would have just put them limb from limb, because that's just, anybody who would think that it's not acceptable to either imprison or kill Ted Bundy should not be having a conversation about violence and nonviolence. So we said, okay, everybody would agree that. So it's okay, fine. How do you get him in prison? Obviously, you need to use force. Nobody's going to walk into prison. Well, Ted Bundy was not going to walk into prison and say, okay, I'll stay here. And so that means that it is acceptable under some circumstances to use some form of force or violence in order to stop some atrocity. You're conceding that. If everybody in the room agrees, it's acceptable to imprison Ted Bundy. And so the next thing is, we just start asking. So what I'm really interested in, I've always been really interested in, is where do we draw those lines personally and socially? Where do we draw the lines to where it's acceptable? One of the things I said to I've said in several interviews, I don't know if I said it last time, that is we would all agree, no, I'll back up. Most of us would agree under most circumstances that it is acceptable to do an act of violence to a carrot. I mean, I'll back up a little bit. Years ago, this pacifist got in an argument with me, and she said that she doesn't believe in violence under any circumstances. And I said, oh, my gosh, so how do you defecate? And the point is that every time you defecate, you kill bazillions of bacteria. And it's like, yeah, so what? But here's my definition of violence. That's part of the problem, too, is when we talk about violence, talk about violent resistance, we talk about any of this, the word's so squishy. I mean, what does violence mean? And in a definition of violence that I really like is violence is any act that does harm to another. And I really like it because it makes it value neutral. And so then the question is, what violence is acceptable to us? Because obviously when I eat a carrot, I am doing violence to the carrot. And if I were to imprison Ted Bundy, I would be doing violence to Ted Bundy. And so the point is that most of us, under most circumstances, would find it acceptable to do an act of violence to a carrot. And most of us, under most circumstances, would find it not acceptable to do an act of violence against a human being, most of us, under most circumstances. So what I'm really interested in is, where do we draw the line both personally and socially? And clearly, socially, this culture does not draw the line at killing the planet, you know? And it doesn't draw the line, I mean, clearly, the United States government no longer draws the line at imprisoning someone without a trial. Well, no longer, sorry. The United States government officially does not draw the line at imprisoning people without trials. So that's where the United States government draws one line there. And so I'm really interested in that question. So to give a short answer to your question about have I always been this way, yeah, you know, 15 years ago, 14 years ago, I wrote a line that has become one of my most cited lines, which is, every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. And what I was trying to get at with that line is that we can write books, we can do activism, we can hold signs, we can occupy places, we can do all sorts of stuff. And those are all symbolic actions. And at some point, something has to change in the real physical world. And it's not a lack of books that's killing salmon. It's dams that are killing salmon. And at some point, you know, it's really, I'm not saying that it's not important to do anti-Nazi propaganda. You know, that was a really important thing to do. But at the same time, you know, the Russians had to destroy the German militarily, and the U.S. and England had to destroy the German capacity to the industrial capacity. And so at some point, you know, yeah, you can make all these movies, Casablanca or whatever, but you still at some point actually have to do something in the real world. And so that has always been really clear to me as well, that symbolic action has to have a point. And that's one of my problems with so much environmentalism, is that basically it consists of begging the capitalist-in-chief to do what the capitalist-in-chief won't do, to have the capitalist-in-chief act against the interests of capital. And it's just crazy. Why don't we just go back and petition the king, you know?
Right.
I mean, everybody understands it doesn't work.
Right. Well,
and anybody who's ever been abused knows that, I mean, anybody who's ever been oppressed is really a better word. Anybody who's ever been oppressed knows that, you know, as Frederick Douglass says, power concedes nothing without demand. And demand, not beg. You know, he didn't say power concedes nothing without begging. It's nothing without demand. And demand means you have the power to back up what you're wanting.
And do you see that playing out? I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I would just, it came into my head. Do you see that playing out with the Keystone Pipeline? I mean, is that something that, I've been, obviously most folks have been keeping an eye on this, folks who are interested in the issue, folks who are interested in environmental issues. But I'm also curious your thoughts on the resistance that has taken place so far with regards to the pipeline. And in some ways, is that what you were referring to when you were making the statement, you know, about this sort of begging to the capitalist in chief now being Obama, and the begging being the, you know, asking to please stop the Keystone Pipeline.
Well, I don't have a problem. I mean, for all my strong words a minute ago, I actually don't have a problem with begging. I think that it can be a fine, it can be fine. I don't care. I don't care how it happens as long as I'm very pragmatic. You know, it's like, I don't really care how it happens as long as it gets done in terms of, you know, people can beg. They can, I mean, if, you know, if they had the same amount of money as the Koch brothers, they could pay off senators, you know, just like the corporations do. They could, you know, it doesn't really matter. I just want something not to be built. My problem comes when they beg and then they don't really have a backup plan except to beg more. And then to pretend that you know, our defeats were near victories, you know? And so I don't, I mean, it's like, I gave some talks both in person and by video at some Occupies, and one of the things I did at the various talks is I would address part of it to the police, and I would say, you know, join us. You have class interests with us. And I contrasted the United States and Syria, actually, where there have been any number of defections by the members of the Syrian military and police who refused to fire on protesters. And I contrasted that with the United States, where there has not been a single, well, he's retired, so he doesn't count. There's not been a single example that I know of any police officer refusing to beat protesters. And so that's pretty bad when, you know, more members of an open police state have, more members of the police state have actually joined the resistance than in a so-called democracy. And so I would talk about that, and at the same time I was still basically, you know, asking nicely and just, you know, here are the reasons, reasoning with them, you know, this is why you should join our side, is because you share class interests with us. And also I was honestly doing some shaming with, so, you know, why do you protect us? I don't know if I told you a story before, but a few years ago I got a note from a guy in Chicago, a police officer in Chicago, saying that he was complaining about how I was treating police in my books. And that he said that the role of police is to protect us from sociopaths. I went back and said, that's all fine, but why don't you protect us from rich sociopaths? And why is it that when strikers go on strike, when workers go on strike, that the police come in? If the police come in, they come in and crack the heads of strikers. Why don't they crack the heads of capitalists? And when there's a WTO meeting, why are you protecting the financiers from the people? why aren't you protecting the people from the financiers? And why didn't you arrest Tony Hayward? You know, why don't you arrest the people associated with Massey Cole? And I said those things too. And once again, my point is, I think it's fine. We need to go through my whole point. I should have just said this shortly. Is that we need to go through every step. It's like first, you know, you ask nicely, and then, you know, please, sir, will you set your slaves free? Okay, that didn't work. Okay. Sir, I think that we're going to have some, you know, you need to release them. Okay, that doesn't work. Okay. You're not going to release them? We're going to release them for you, you know? I don't have a problem with begging as such. It's just that's only the first line. And when you see that doesn't work, then you go to the second one. In the case of the Keystone XL pipeline, I would be interested to see. I mean, I actually think that Obama was really, really smart on this because, you know, every year, every 4 years, every 2 years really, but every 4 years especially, for I don't know how long now, basically the Democrats, their only way to get any votes whatsoever really from thinking people is to say, look, we're not as fascist as the others, so it's a lesser of two evils. You know, Gore's a lesser of two evils, Kerry lesser of two evils, so on and on and on. They tried that again in 2008. I mean, you really want McCain? And then it's like there's been an increasing recognition, at least among some Democrats, that they've been had any number of times. And so I thought it was brilliant on Obama's part to attempt to put this off until after the election, because this way he can say, no, I know you don't believe in this anymore, but if you don't let me in one more time, then they're going to get the Keystone XL. It's like they're going to a very specific thing that will try to get some environmentalists to vote for him, even though his environmental record is even worse than George Bush.
Sure. Sure. I actually I don't want to switch gears, but I'd like to do something different than I've done in the past, because obviously I don't wish to have a confrontational conversation with you. But I would like to play devil's advocate in the sense that I've heard a lot of objections to obviously different forms of resistance, militant resistance, violence, and so on, or the different uses of force and violence. And obviously it's seen as a somewhat controversial issue, if not an outright controversial issue to many folks. I would like to ask a few questions from the perspective of someone who might adhere to pacifist ideology. And now these are either things that I've heard in the past from folks, or these are just common, I think, lines or phrases that people coming from that angle would bring up when confronted with your perspective or from a different perspective. That something we can go with?
That's great.
Okay. So you've made the statement that this culture is built upon and literally exists due to the use of widespread violence. But I don't see this violence every day. So what do you mean when you're talking about this use of violence, and for folks who might not see these forms of violence in a day-to-day, going to the store, buying groceries, coming home, watching TV, going shopping and things like this? Maybe they haven't seen anything violent throughout their entire day. How is this culture built on that violence?
Well, first off, it's a lot easier for a man to say that than a woman, because 25% of all women in this culture are raped in their lifetime, and the 19% are not rape attempts. And all the women I know say those are gold standard studies. All the women I know say those figures are really low, and so the rates are much higher. And so there's a great line by Robin Morgan. She says, anywhere in the world, any woman can be walking alone late at night, and if she hears footfalls behind her, she has reason to be afraid. And she calls that the democracy of fear. And so first off, systematic violence by men against women has fundamentally changed the behavior of women. I mean, okay, I'm just going to – this is not a rhetorical question. Do you feel reasonably safe walking alone down the street at midnight?
Right. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just a regular street, you know, not a scary street somehow. Or if you were alone in a huge office building and you're walking down the hall and all of a sudden you hear footsteps behind you and you turn around and you see a woman and you're like the only two people on that floor, would you be afraid?
No.
Okay. Many women would be afraid in those circumstances. So right there, there's one way that, and that affects the behavior, seriously affects the behavior of 50% of the population, 51% actually. Okay, so there's one way, but then we'll throw that out for a second. And so my next question that I like to ask when people, so part of the reason that we don't see a lot of this violence is because we're so fully metabolized into the system that that it's invisible to us. And so one of the things I like to ask if people say they don't see any violence is, so I'll just ask this of you. Do you pay rent?
Absolutely.
Okay. Why do you pay rent?
Well, I pay rent because otherwise there's going to be serious repercussions.
Okay. So basically you pay rent because if you don't, a sheriff presumably will come and evict you, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. And so basically the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and kick you out of your home. And so one of the reasons that we don't perceive paying rent as violent is because we're so fully metabolized. This is normal. This is what you do. Except, once again, fundamentally, it's the same with a grocery store. What would happen if you went to the grocery store and you're really, really hungry, so you just start eating? What will happen?
Arrested or at least kicked out.
Yeah, I mean, if you keep doing it, if you go in, you know, you go in for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they're going to call, it's probably the same sheriff, you know, he's going to come and take you away. And one of the reasons that this, yeah, it's like, yeah, we just... Anyway, you got something against people getting paid for bringing food, but the problem is that we have to pay in order to actually exist. In order to sleep somewhere, you've got to pay. In order to eat something, you have to pay. And when you eat something, you're not paying Farmer Joan or Farmer John. You're actually, there's like four companies control about 80%. I'm making up the numbers. It could be four companies control 90%, whatever. It's about right. Four or five companies control about 80% or 90% of the grain market, of the beef market, of most of these markets. And so basically you're paying to some distant corporation in order to survive. And one of the reasons this is really important is because there was an 1830s pro-slavery philosopher from the South who wrote to his northern abolitionist capitalist buddy saying that there are land ownership conditions in which it's in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves or not own slaves. And said, we would release our slaves immediately if we could arrange land ownership conditions like you got up there. And it's very simple, which is if you've got a lot of land and not many people, then that means that the only way you can get people to work for you is at the point of a gun. Because if there's a lot of land and not many people, that means people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means there is no way they're going to go to work for you. On the other hand, if you have not much land and a lot of people, and in that case, people don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they have to go to work for you for whatever pittance you want to pay them. And my point is, and this has been used, central to setting up the apartheid laws in South Africa was the question, they were set up, I don't know if you know this, I didn't know this until I did the research for Cultural Make-Believe, it's pretty interesting, that those laws were set up specifically to make workers for mines, because nobody in their right mind wants to go work in a mine. It's unsafe, it's horrible, and so how do they get people to work in mines? They set up taxes to bring them into the wage economy, to the cash economy. There was a hut tax, a poll tax. And if you're not working in a wage, if you're not working in a cash economy in the first place, you have no cash, which means you have to go to work to earn money in order to pay for stuff, as opposed to being self-sufficient. So one of the ways, one of the reasons that a lot of us don't perceive a lot of this violence is because we don't step out of line at all. We're so fully metabolizing this and we don't see it. Another reason a lot of us don't perceive the violence is because it's the United States is a giant gated community with the military as the gatekeepers. And the only way you can, I mean, the United States economy runs on oil. And one, I mean, you, I'm not saying this about you personally, but you as a devil's advocate, you really believe that the tar sands aren't violent? And you really believe that taking oil out of Nigeria isn't violent? And you think it's a coincidence that there is an absolute monarch in Saudi Arabia? In order to gain access to oil, it has to be ripped from the ground, and the people who live on that land have to be ripped from the ground too. So one of the reasons we don't perceive a lot of the violence is because it's overseas. It's exported. And some of Gail Dine's, she does great anti-pornography work. Some of Gail Dine's students have, I don't remember exactly what it was. It was some of her students were doing some work for some major clothing company. I can't remember which it was. And they would routinely receive notes tucked into the pants pockets saying, please help us. And those notes were written by, you know, young women working in sweatshops in Southeast Asia. And I mean, so the only way that someone cannot believe that this, and besides, let's back up for a second. 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone. Coral reefs are supposed to have, what, 30 years left? They've been here for millions of years? And that doesn't count as violence? I mean, this culture is based on violence against everyone. Everyone outside, you know, any others. And that's part of the problem, too, is that there's a great line by this Portuguese explorer in Africa. He was talking about Africans and why it was okay to enslave them because, quote, when they speak, they fart with their tongues in their mouths. And the point is they didn't speak Portuguese, which means they didn't speak. And oh, and here's another – this will tie to it and I was talking earlier about my friend, the Dakota activist, and, you know, Minnesota is Dakota and Anishinaabe land, and they have, I think, 1/10 of 1% of the land they used to have. I mean, so people are living on stolen property as well, stolen land. And so that involves violence, too. I mean, the American Indians didn't say, hey, you want some land? Your way of life is much better than ours. So I mean, this way of life is based on – in fact, there's a great – have you heard of what's it called? Marshall v. Something v. McIntosh. I can't remember the first part. It's this great court ruling in about 18. Great, but it's horrible. It's in the 1820s. Johnson v. McIntosh. And in this, the Supreme Court of the United States actually said that it recognized that this entire way of life is based on land theft and conquest. But it said, if your entire way of life is based on land theft and conquest, you cannot question that land theft and conquest, and it becomes a law of the land. So even, I mean, any pacifists who think this way of life is not based on violence, that's an even more reactionary position than that take. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court was more honest than they were. So, yeah, I mean, do you want me to talk more about that invisible violence, or have we sort of hit that one enough?
No, I think that's great. It's also often said that using the master's tools to dismantle the master's house inevitably leads to further repression and violence. So if the state uses violence, as you had mentioned before, I believe you said either Lierre Keith or Eric McBay made that clear distinction. The line from Arundhati Roy's book, why should activists and organizers consider such forms of violence? Or such forms of resistance, I'm sorry.
First off, I simply don't think it's true that you can't use the master's tools to dismantle a master's house. On the physical level, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. The metaphor, I love Audre Lorde, but that metaphor doesn't make any sense to me at all. Because it doesn't make sense on a physical level. It doesn't matter. You can use your tools, my tools. You can use, you know, your Uncle Jed's tools. You can steal tools from Walmart. It doesn't matter. You know, it's like a tool is a tool. A hammer is a hammer. And you can use it to dismantle a house. And so that's the first problem with it. The second problem with it is it presumes that violence is one of the master's tools. And those in power have convinced us that they own land, and that's just a shared hallucination, really. They don't own, nobody owns land. I own a piece of paper, you own a piece of paper, somebody owns a piece of paper that says that they do or don't own this particular land. But we just agree they do. It doesn't mean anything. Anyway, so they say, they've convinced us they own the land. They've convinced us they own the water rights. They've convinced us that they own, with carbon trading, they're going to convince us they can own the air. And they've convinced us that they own genetic materials, because you can patent genetically modified organisms. You can patent seeds. So they've convinced us they own all these things, and now we're supposed to let them convince us that they own violence too? I mean, I don't agree that those in power have a monopoly on violence, and I think Mother Grizzly Bears would back me up on this one. That's part of the problem, is this belief that they have a monopoly on it. That's one of their tools. But for crying out loud, who owns the major media in this country? Not who personally, but who? I mean, corporations, right?
Right.
So clearly discourse is one of the master's tools, right?
Well, right, if you're going to follow that logic, sure.
Well, so we can't use that tool either if it's one of the master's tools, right?
Right.
And then also, basically, you know, those in power, they use spirituality. Does that mean we can't use spirituality? Can we not use anything they use? Are we supposed to? I mean, that's the thing, is I'm not really interested in purity. I'm interested in getting something done. And there are circumstances. I mean, the world's being killed, and people ask me all the time if I advocate violence, and I always say no. Nor do I advocate nonviolence. What I advocate is putting all of our options on the table and discussing them openly and honestly and trying to figure out what we're going to do to stop this absolutely crazy culture from killing the planet. That can include spiritual transformation. It can include wading into a pond to bring, to help frogs somehow. It can help, it can include many, many things. I mean, I don't know if we talked about this last time. Did we talk about George Elser?
I don't believe so.
Okay. One guy all by himself almost stopped World War II. That was George Elser. He was a trade unionist who did not like what Hitler was doing to the trade unions. And so he got a job at a mine so he could steal some explosives, and then he went to Munich, and I believe he was a watchmaker by trade, and he built a timer, and then every night he would sneak into this restaurant where every year Hitler would give a speech on a certain day, and then he carved out a hole on the pillar behind him and then covered it over with veneer every night, and he put the bomb in there and set it to go off at, I don't know, 8:20 or something. Hitler always gave the speech from 8 to 8:30, say. Set it to go off at 8:20. That year, because it was foggy, Hitler gave the speech from 7 to 8 because he had to go on a train instead of flying because of the fog, and it went off at 8:20. Had it gone off when he was there, Hitler would have died. And everybody who talks about resistance to Hitler says that with Hitler dead in 1939, which is the year he tried to do this, there would have been no World War II. And the world would happily lost, you know, that would. So in this case, I think it would take someone who is insane to argue against assassinating Hitler and to argue against George Elser. George Elser all by himself almost stopped World War II. So my point is, and I want to be absolutely clear, I'm not suggesting that, you know, the assassination is I'm not suggesting that the assassination is appropriate in the United States for a number of reasons, one of which is that there's not the same sort of centralization of power as there was. The only thing I'm saying is that there are some circumstances where violent resistance is absolutely appropriate. And why is it that so many people can see that it was appropriate to violently resist against the Nazis? And it's like years ago I did I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, MRTA, rebel group in Peru. And I was going to do – I emailed – in 1997, and I emailed the editor of The Nation. And they were all excited. I said, you know, I want to do an interview with MRTA. Are you interested? They said, yeah, sounds great. And then we had a phone call about it, and she said, so what are you going to talk about? And I said, well, I'm going to talk about their struggle there and what they want for the people of Peru. And then also, I think I want to talk about the importance of, and she was excited, I want to talk about the importance of actually, if you really want to help people in the colonies, what we need to do is we need to bring down capitalism in the United States. And suddenly she was no longer interested. It's like, sorry, I got to talk to the editors and I'll get back to you. And wrote me an email like 15 minutes saying, nope, not interested. And the point is that why is it okay for someone to have resisted 150 years ago, or for someone to resist in some other country, especially brown people to resist in some other country? Why is that okay? But then when we talk about it here, someone becomes morally problematical. I think I find that an extremely problematical position to take, and privileged position to take.
Well, and it probably ties back to what you were saying before, both in terms of race, ethnicity, gender, and also the exporting of such violence. So then, of course, for the, you know, vast majority of what was the white middle class of America, or even parts of the working class, for this violence to be exported and for them not to have to deal with state repression the way black neighborhoods do, or the way that women have to deal, excuse me, with sexual assault and things like this. I guess what I'm saying is, as you're talking, I'm thinking about your previous point about this violence being exported and how these things take place over there or to the other or somewhere else. So I find that to be interesting.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting stuff, really important stuff.
How about when folks would say, maybe we should simply be patient, use the proper modes of organizing, reject, you know, radical actions, and not alienate those who may be on the fence, so to speak, by using other forms of resistance? Are you worried that such tactics could discourage prospective organizers or activists?
I think that those are important questions that need to be discussed. And I think that there were some ways I think that the weather underground was useful. And I think that there are some ways that it harmed SDS, for example. And so I think it's a tactical answer. It's a strategic and tactical question. And that said, 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species are going to go extinct tomorrow. And even the, IEA? I'm blanking on it right now. You know, this major conservative international energy, no, it wasn't, I can't remember right now. Anyway, they said we've got 5 years, or there's going to be basically absolutely catastrophic global warming. And this is a conservative intergovernmental agency. This is not radical environmentalists. 5 years to dramatically change things, and it's not happening. And so I wish there was time to organize. You know, it's like you look at the civil rights movement, and many of the civil rights leaders were the children, grandchildren of Pullman porters who were children and grandchildren of enslaved peoples. And so there's this unbroken lineage of resistance that went on for, you know, 100-150 years. And it takes generations to build through. I mean, for crying out loud, how long were the Irish trying to get the British out of Ireland? 800 years. And they're still not entirely out. And it takes a long time, but because we don't have that time. And it's really important to remember that only 2% of the IRA even picked up weapons. The IRA itself, this is not just Irish supporters, but only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. And so the vast majority of the work that needs to be done is completely above ground and requires that mass organizing. But at the same time, we need to write, I just wrote this essay a couple days ago. You know, I've been saying for years that we don't live in a democracy, and everybody knows we don't live in a democracy, that it's, you know, when I ask people of any, you know, it's not just radicals, but anybody. You can ask somebody on a bus, on a subway, on a, you know, walking at a football game, doesn't matter where. If you ask anybody, does the government take better care of corporations or human beings? Everybody says corporations. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows it's a government by, of, and for corporations, not human beings. Everybody knows that. So there's a sense in which we don't live in democracy, but there's another sense in which we do live in democracy. And the sense in which we do live in democracy has to do with how people spend their actual time. It has to do with their sort of beliefs in action. And one of the things I said in the essay that I just wrote within the past week or so is that I said I was thinking about tigers and not real tigers, not the tigers being driven extinct in the wild, but rather I was thinking about the Louisiana State University Tigers football team, which is currently ranked number one in the country. And next month, LSU is going to play Alabama for the college championship, and 70,000 people are going to attend. And the lowest ticket prices already are $1,500, and the good seats go for more than $5,000. And the region's so excited about all that they're, the schools have announced closures, the television audience will be in the millions. And my point is that more people in the United States care about the Louisiana State University Tigers than care about real Tigers. Same for Detroit Tigers, Miami Marlins, Carolina Panthers, whatever. And another thing about this is that, I mean, can you imagine 70,000 people getting together to clean up the Gulf and pay to do it and do it every weekend as they do for sporting events? I love sports. Don't get me wrong. I really like sports. But can you imagine 70,000 people getting together to clean up Cancer Alley? And we're only talking about the deaths of children. And then, or another way to look at this is contrast the number of hours that are spent consuming pornography to the number of hours that are spent working on rape crisis hotlines or battered women's shelters. Another example, I just love this example, is I live in Northern California, and when you think of Northern California, what is the first domesticated plant that you think of?
Oh, to be honest with you, I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Marijuana.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that would be the...
When people think of Northern California, and they think, I should have put it a different way. When people think of marijuana, you think of... Marijuana is the biggest cash crop in the United States. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah, and one out of every five houses in Arcata, one county south of where I live, is a grow house.
Oh, I've got a friend that lives in Arcata. It's unbelievable. The entire culture is built around... growing or consuming or purchasing or manufacturing of marijuana.
Yep.
It was the most unbelievable. It was a culture shock moment, to be honest with you, when I spent time. In Eureka and Arcata, and it was with several folks that I had served with, and one of which has a home in Arcata. I was blown away. I mean, I could not. And then, of course, I did the questioning, I think, somewhat of what you're getting at. And I asked myself, or when we were sitting around at night, drinking and smoking and chilling out, I'd say, hey, like, could we imagine the amount of time and energy that people have put into organizing around marijuana and cannabis rights to changing or taking over the system? You know, my point was always that people would say, well, we need to get marijuana legalized and da 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 da. And I'd say, yeah, I agree. And to be honest with you, in some ways, that plant has, and I got to be careful what I say, has helped me in ways that antidepressants, sleeping pills, and anti-anxiety pills that the Veterans Administration wants to push down my throat hasn't helped me. So there's something to be said on that level. But I always argued with folks, I'd say, look, or tried to rationalize with folks, I'd say, you know, if we took over the system, then of course all of us know if we were the ones who were creating the laws or if we wanted to have laws or whatever the system was, of course marijuana would be legal. So why don't we bypass all of the lawsuits and the nonsense and let's just go straight for taking over the system? That way we don't have to worry about that. I know that might sound in some ways naive, but you know, in other ways, I thought it was a great way to bring up the point to people that you know, if we,
I think it's fabulous.
If we stop,
it's absolutely fabulous.
Know, if we stop messing around on the edges and dealt with the core issue of power, who has power,
right,
who makes decisions, who doesn't make decisions, then a lot of these other issues to me are just, of course marijuana would be legal. Of course, X, you know, X, Y, and Z would happen. I think some of that just simply follows by folks, addressing power relations.
Yeah, I completely agree. And a couple things. One is, you know, I live in Northern California. I can say this legally because it's absolutely legal here, that, you know, I have Crohn's disease, and, it's pretty miraculous for Crohn's. And, actually, one of the things I've been doing is drinking juice, marijuana leaf juice. My Prop 215 doctor got me started on this, and it's been very helpful. Anyway, but the point I was going to bring up is, it's along the lines of what you're saying, that, maybe different counties, the state law is that different counties get to determine how many plants you can have legally. And Del Norte, which is the county I live in, at one point they allowed you to have 99 plants and at a time. And the county commissioners were going to reduce that to 6. And during their Board of Supervisors, which is county commissioners, which during the Board of Supervisors meeting, it was a glorious example of participatory democracy in action, because the people turned out en masse and did not allow the supervisors to drop it to 6. They dropped it to something, I don't know what, but it's way, way, way more than 6. And the point is that the people disallowed. This is how participatory democracy is supposed to work. That's the good news. The bad news is that I wish that people loved salmon as much as they love marijuana. You know, I wish that they would come out en masse for this. So my point having to do with the fence sitters is they're never going to be on our side. And so I don't really worry so much about them. But what we need are, yes, we need to organize, but we need to do that yesterday. We don't have time anymore. We are up against a terrible, terrible deadline. And in fact, for 200 species, the deadline was today, and 200 species will be the deadline tomorrow. So we need to move quickly, but that doesn't mean that we can't think. You know, we got to think strategically, and we have to think. We have to figure out, and we have to build this resistance movement, which, to take us back to the beginning of the conversation, is one of the reasons we had Earth at Risk.
Well, and isn't the knowledge that we have now and the developments specifically in the last 30 to 40 years, if not, of course, you make the distinction between pre and post industrial civilization, but let's just go back 30 or 40 years. This is the X factor in my thinking, and it's something that's sort of left out of the common discourse with activists and organizers and workshops that I've been to, and I think conferences that you're talking about and that I've been to as well, labor conferences, anti-war conferences, peace and justice conferences, where, I mean, I think, of course, it's very important to talk about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the American empire, American imperialism, tying these issues together. However, at the end of the day, that's what scares me. If indeed 200 species are dying a day, then this is an X factor that we must take into consideration, that previous social scientists, activists, intellectuals, organizers, citizens, did not have the knowledge of, and simply were not conceptualizing the way that folks are out there today, such as yourself and the thousands of other activists, authors, and so on, who are bringing up these issues, in a very fundamental way. This to me seems like the issue. Yes, we could talk about marijuana rights. Yes, we could talk about collective bargaining rights for union members. And I know that those are very real, material, concrete issues, because I'm dealing with folks in a working class, blue collar, Northwest Indiana area. So I get it. I get the very real material concerns of people right here, right now. Same with my parents and Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, things like that. But, you know, I always try and at least inject into the conversation the fact that we are dealing with a situation now that previous generations either A, didn't have the knowledge of, B, chose not to deal with, or C, they had more time than we did. I mean, and that's something I always hear Lyra Keith talk about, and I'm hoping to have her on the program in the coming weeks. And you know, she always talks about that time, that we are simply running out of time. There is no more space for this, you know, these ongoing intellectual discourses about this and this. And I enjoy some of that at times. But in the back of my mind, or at the forefront of my mind, I should say, it's always this urgency, this sense of we need to be doing something. We need to be doing something significant and fundamental now. Because 5 years ago, I was reading your work and I'm thinking, wow, we're in a serious situation. And now it's 2012 and I'm thinking, wow, we're in a serious situation. And I don't want to be in 2017 going, wow, we're in an even more serious situation. And it's just, I don't know. It gets frustrating. I mean, obviously you've been doing it for much longer than I have. But it's this, I don't know. How do you, you know, build that sense of urgency in common folks who are just trying to deal with how to pay the rent every day? I think that's a real challenge.
Well, I think one of the things I do is I often try to figure out, do the best I can to figure out what is important to people. And, you know, if someone is a small business owner who is losing a business because Walmart moved in, I don't necessarily talk to them about salmon because they probably don't care. Instead, I talk about corporations destroying their livelihood and try to find places where we can start to meet, and then we can build from there. One of the stories I love, and it's true, is years and years ago, gosh, 20 years ago now, I lived in Spokane, Washington. I was way up in the forest getting firewood from slash piles in the National Forest. And my truck got a flat tire, and I hadn't checked the spare in years, and the spare was flat. So I'm not going to walk out of it, so I'm just thumping along about 1 mile an hour. And I get this guy's house and ask him if he's got a pump. And he says, no, I don't, but I got a spare tire. So he gives me a spare tire. I drive home, and my mom makes him a cake, and I get my tire fixed, and I drive back up and give him his spare back, and I take him the cake. He invites me in for, you know, have a piece, and so we have a piece of cake. And he says, by the way, you're up here getting firewood. Do you want another load? I got plenty out and back. And I say, sure, that'd be great. And it's clear from everything on his wall he's a logger. So then we walk outside, and he's standing there holding a chainsaw in his hand, and he says, by the way, what do you do? I'm thinking, I'm a writer. And he says, well, what do you write? I'm thinking science fiction, fantasy, romance, but I'm a terrible liar. And so I tell him the truth, which is, at the time, I was working on a book about how the big four timber companies got their land in the Pacific Northwest, got their land illegally from the public domain. And I say this, and he starts swearing and turns red in the face. And I'm looking for a break in the fence. It takes me about 20 seconds to figure out that he's an independent logger who's been put out of business by Plum Creek Timber Company. He hates the company even worse than I do, which I didn't think was possible. And so then we're just, you know, we've got our arms around each other's shoulders, just swapping atrocity stories of Plum Creek, how much we hate them. And then, you know, we're talking. We agree, you know, that we're going to bring down Plum Creek. And I say, you know, I'm actually against all industrial logging, so after we take out Plum Creek, I'm coming after you. And then he and I both just laughed and laughed and laughed because we recognize it would take our lives, our lifetimes, to take down Plum Creek. And our difference was really theoretical. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right.
So I can work with, you know, it's like, great, I want to bring down civilization, but in the meantime, there needs to be universal health care. And in the meantime, I believe in the rights of union workers as long as they're not kowtowing to big business, or as long as they're not pushing forward the jobs versus environment crap that they sometimes do,
right?
In which case I can't work with them. But if we can find a place to, like this independent logger, if we can find a place to agree on, it's like, yeah, let's work together. I believe in temporary alliances. That's really the short way of saying everything I've said. I believe in making tactical alliances that will move things forward. And then when it's like, I've never really understood why hunters and animal rights activists, not slob hunters, but better hunters, good hunters, why don't work together to protect habitat It's like, we both agree there needs to be more habitat. And then once we get the habitat for these creatures, then the animal rights people can go try to stab the hunt. It's like, why don't we agree we're going to work together to make habitat, but then we disagree on the other, and we'll fight. You know, we can scratch and claw at each other all the time on the other issue, but let's work together on the one we can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I know we're running up on time, too, so I'm going to apologize because I know I brought you a little over an hour or two.
Oh, that's great. Your interviews are fun.
And I've got two more questions. I could skip the Marxist question because it's really irrelevant and this conversation's moving along great, but there are two more questions that I would like to finish with if that's possible.
Great.
Okay, cool. So how about those within the environmental movement? And I know you've talked about this before, but I would like to obviously follow a line in this conversation, and I think this works well. There are those who believe that more, you know, simple consumer choices, such as purchasing hybrid cars, recycling, or taking showers, not that those actions are not important or not that you shouldn't maybe live simple, that could lead to a better planet and encourage people to participate in this internal sort of individual change that you had mentioned before. Why are these proposed solutions so troublesome, and how does this thinking indicate a sense of powerlessness? As you had mentioned, I know in previous lectures that I've watched on YouTube, you've mentioned almost a psychological dynamic to this feeling or this idea of the victim constantly blaming oneself, or of victims blaming other victims, and so on. Can you tie this together for us?
Well, yeah. You know, in the 1980s was the first time that the corporate press called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And that's a really important switch of identification for people, because if they can get you to identify as a consumer then and not as a citizen, your range of resistance is much limited. I can either buy or not buy. As a citizen, you can either buy or not buy, or vote or not vote, or you can organize. You can, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it if you're a citizen and not a consumer. Consumer doesn't have that option. And there's another change I just need to say for completeness that has happened a couple thousand years ago, which is when we had the transformation from being human animals who need habitat and who need community into citizens of the state, where, to take one of the themes of this conversation, you grant the state a monopoly on violence. And the state's supposed to take care of you. And you forget that you have teeth and you have claws. But backing up, the whole idea of taking shorter showers, one of the things it does, I mean, if you there's all these movies, you know, like An Inconvenient Truth, I mean, but all these environmental movies do this, it just bugs the crap out of me, that they will lay out very well the problems. You know, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth just lays out the problems great, but then the solutions always, you know what solutions they didn't include? They didn't include anything that had to do with corporate power. They didn't include anything that had to do with a lack of democracy. They didn't include anything that had to do with stopping a growth economy. And plus, they're incredibly, or it's like Food Inc. does this great job of describing how the agricultural system, the food production system, is really atrocious on every level and exploitative on every level to everybody. And then the solution is to buy yogurt from Walmart, if you can believe it. It's crazy. And so anyway, back to the point that, oh, two things. One is that with An Inconvenient Truth, if everybody in the United States did everything that Al Gore suggested, it would only reduce carbon emissions by about 22 or 23%. And since he's not arguing against the growth economy, then what that does is all those changes would disappear, those changes would go away pretty quickly anyway. But back to the real point, people say you got to take shorter showers because the world's running out of water, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not where the real action is. 90% of the water used by human beings is used for agriculture and industry. 90%. Municipal human beings, people who live in cities, use only the same amount of water as municipal golf courses. So when people tell you to take a shorter shower, what that's doing is it's shifting the focus away from where it needs to be to where the real action is onto something that's really pretty trivial in terms of actual consumption. So you can take a shorter shower, but that's a really short lever. Why don't you destroy golf courses? You know, that would do a much better. If you want to save water, that saves as much water as the entire municipality for human use. It's like if the Grand, I'm sorry, if the dams on the Colorado River were to fail and the river were once again to reach the ocean, which, I mean, it doesn't even reach the ocean anymore. If it were once again to reach the ocean, I could just hear the corporate press just braying that, oh, people are going to die of thirst. But I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there exists a single irrigated alfalfa field in Arizona, or so long as there exists a single pool or lawn, or so long as Las Vegas existed. I wouldn't want to hear any word of complaint, or a semiconductor factory. I wouldn't want to hear a single word of complaint so long as those existed, because, yes, people are dying of thirst, but they're not dying of thirst because there's not enough water. They're dying of thirst because the water is being stolen for use by agriculture and industry. It's even more so when it comes to waste, that, you know, we have to reduce, reuse, and recycle, and we need to not produce trash. I should live pretty simply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate. It's not for a political reason. And, yeah, I don't produce much trash, but here's the thing, is that the average person in the United States produces somewhere, I don't know, 2,600 pounds of trash, something like that, 3,000 pounds of trash a year. That's the average, how much you put out, I put out, if we're average. And so let's pretend somebody reduces that to zero. They buy nothing with packaging. They repair their toaster. They wear their tennis shoes until they're falling off their feet. That's great. They reduce it to zero. We've got bad news. And the bad news is that per capita trash production in the United States is actually 26 tons. And 97% of that is agriculture and industry, once again. So you reduce it to zero. You've worked so hard to reduce this a trivial amount. Whereas if you want to actually reduce it, you go to the source of power. You stop agriculture and industry. And that's a huge, it's like stage magic, you know, prestidigitation, where, you know, look over here, but the real action's over there. And so it's tremendous, it's a tremendous distraction and waste time we don't have. And then further, I just had this debate with this guy in print a while back where he was saying that buying fair trade is a way to actually affect social change. And don't get me wrong, I think buying fair trade is a great idea. And I belong to a CSA, a Community Supported Agriculture here, just so I can support the local farmers, you know? So I believe in doing that, but I don't believe that's a way to do social change. And the reason is that it's the logic of capitalism. Well, there's two reasons that this doesn't really work. One of them is that I have a choice. I go into a store and I can buy, you know, fancy schmancy fair trade product A for $5 or for $10, or I can buy sweatshop made product B for $1. The only way that I can pay the extra $9 per item, I mean, actually a real good example of this is that I want to support the local computer store owner, the local small town. I like him. He's a really nice guy, and I bought my laptop from him. Walmart is literally a block away, and the problem is that this computer store owner, he can only buy laptops more expensive than Walmart can sell them. He buys them wholesale, more expensive than Walmart sells them. And so the only way that I could buy the laptop from him is if I had an extra $100 to burn. And so the logic of capitalism means that that buying fair trade or buying organic, for that matter, or non-genetically modified, it basically will remain a niche market, and it can't affect change on the more global scale, because the logic of capitalism is going to drive people to buy the cheaper object. That's the whole point. That's one of the problems. Another of the problems is that it remains white man's burden, in that it's our job to raise them up. But what people in the colonies really want is to be left alone. It's like part of the debate, one of the things the guy said is, okay, let's say you and I both go into some non-industrialized nation, and what I would call the colonies, and he says, you provide the best the best critique of capitalism ever, and I provide them with a better-paying job. He says, which of us is going to have more friends? And my response was, first off, social change isn't based on how many friends you've got, nor sustainability. Second, but more important, is let's switch it. And let's say one of us goes in to offer them a better job, and the other one comes in and says, I will help you however you need to be helped or wish to be helped. I will help you to take back your land from the transnational corporations and to take back your river from the transnational corporations, and I will help you to be able to be self-sufficient back on the land that is yours. Which of us is going to have more friends then?
Right.
It's like years ago when I interviewed the MRTA people, I know we're over, but when I interviewed the MRTA people, I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And he said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. That's what they want, is to be left alone. So that's the real thing. It comes back to that question again. If you really want to help the people of India, of Bangladesh, then what you need to do is stop Chevron from destroying their land, or stop, you know, BP from destroying their land. I don't know who's in Bangladesh. South America, I know Chevron's been doing a lot of really bad things. Or if you want to help the people of Nigeria, stop Shell Oil.
Right. Well, and I think from a different angle, and I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but I posted something on the Veterans Unplugged website, I believe probably a couple weeks ago, and I used some of the material for the program. But the Slovenian philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, he has a really, I think, a great critique of what he calls cultural capitalism and this idea that somehow consumer choices are going to fulfill these goals of creating a more sustainable earth. And he takes it from a psychoanalytic point of view. And also, I guess I will say about his work, too, he's one of the few leftist philosophers, theoreticians out there today who are willing to talk about the ecological crisis and also talk about armed resistance. And so I on that level, I have to definitely praise his work for those things. I've got one last question for you. And this is, we could finish probably on more of a personal note, but we don't have, I mean, it's not... not necessarily that personal of a question, but, you know, your work is dead serious. Obviously, it confronts what are really the most pressing issues of our time in a very fundamental way, and invokes this sense of urgency that we talked about earlier, which is often lacking on the American left. So I guess in short, personally, how do you deal with this knowledge of ecological crisis and the ongoing and ever-growing ecological devastation caused by industrial civilization? You know, obviously, while trying to simultaneously maintain a personal life, a social life, you know, community relations, just chilling out, taking some time for yourself, a lot of times when I'm reading some of this more serious material, it's difficult to wind down, you know, find that time, to find that balance, to be able to have friends and folks operating in many different ways, you know, not just friends who are full-time activists and so on. How do you do that? I mean, I think, is that something I've actually had a lot of activists and other folks ask me to start asking some of the guests on the program, not personal questions, but just simply, how do you live while doing this work in a sane way, or in a somewhat sane way?
Well, for me, the most important thing is I actually don't have any friends in my life with whom I have to revisit Civilization as Bad 101 every time I open my mouth. I don't actually have any friends with whom I have to fight about pacifism. Because this is what I live and breathe. This is what I talk about all the time. I mean, it's not a time to. I want to put one exception, which is so many people have asked me over the years. It's so funny. Probably 10 different people over the last 10 years have asked me, so what do you do at family gatherings like Thanksgiving? And, you know, I can't tell you how many Thanksgivings I've ruined by talking about genocide.
Right.
And at this point, honestly, I mean, if I get together with a group like that, I just talk about baseball, you know. It's like, I don't want to make a fight. But that's like a special occasion. And normally, you know, in my day-to-day experience, there's no one in my life that I can't talk to about mass extinction. And it's so great to be able to call up a friend and say, oh, man, such a drag. The stock market went up 300 points today. That's terrible. When is it going to crash? And it's really good to not have to defend it. I lost a friend in my 20s because we were just chatting about cloning was just starting. And I said, hey, maybe they could clone, mastodons again or something. And I was 24 or 25 or something. It's like, maybe they clone mastodons again. And so then they'd be making an extinct species come back instead of driving a species extinct. And he looked at me and said, what's wrong with driving species extinct? And that was pretty much the end of our friendship. We didn't fight about it. It's just, I don't have the energy to spend, and I don't have the interest in spending time with people. So that's part of it. It's just I don't waste energy on having those fights anymore. And another part, I cry, you know? It's like, it's terrible. It's terrible. It's just, and another part is I work harder because I don't want to think. You know, when I was in eighth grade and about to try out for the football team, a friend of mine said something really smart, which is, try as hard as you can because you don't want to go the rest of your life wishing you would have tried a little bit harder. And that's so true. You know, it's like if my work makes any difference on the sort of planetary scale, I don't want to think that if I would have worked a little bit harder, it would have made that much more difference, you know? And also, honestly, I was just thinking about this about 10 minutes before you called. I was thinking, you know, there are a lot of writers with talent, and just like there's a lot of musicians with talent. And in addition to being blessed with some talent, you also have to have some lucky breaks. And, I mean, I'm so blessed to have been... I'm so blessed to be actually in a position where I'm doing what I love and doing what I have a gift for and it being, you know, at least somewhat received. And let's say somewhat because it's pretty funny. My nonfiction, you know, gets out there okay for the most part. And my fiction, I've got a couple, three books out. And my joke is I've actually spent more hours writing those books than actual all the readers put together have spent reading them. Because, you know, like 600 people have bought them or something is all. Anyway, the point is that, you know, I'm so blessed, but, you know, you look at like some tremendously talented football player, baseball player, you know, if they've got some talent and then they just sort of waste it on something, I don't want to be one of those. And also, when I'm in this position to actually maybe help. So I work really hard. And then also, I've been pretty ruthless in my life, and Crohn's disease has actually helped me with this. I've been pretty ruthless with cutting things or people out of my life who are who detract from my life. I mean, the most important question I can ever think of for any relationship of any sort is better in than out, you know? Am I better off in or out of this relationship? And I've stuck with some you know, friendships that have not been particularly helpful for me, but I've really tried to hone my life such that it... And the reason Crohn's has helped, or the way Crohn's has helped, is that if I'm unhappy, I get sick, you know? And my guts tell me. You know, I get really bad diarrhea when I'm not very happy. And so I've worked, you know, I've tried to set up my life that is such that it's conducive to living this life. And one more thing, you know, I'm going to do something now in this interview that I almost never, never do, which is, I don't know if you've noticed in my books, but I almost never talk about my romantic life.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I do that is because I share so much, I want to keep some things just for myself. But there's actually, and my closest friends, there's one story I want to tell right now that has to do with this, which is, I don't know, 10 or 11 years ago, I was in this relationship that was not going very well. And the person on my mom did not get along at all. And at one point, the person it was kind of weird. The person wrote a letter to my mom saying, why don't you like me? And my mom's like, why am I going to respond to this? And then she actually did respond to it. And she wrote back, and her answer has to do with everything we're talking about here. Her answer was, I don't actually know you very well, but I have to tell you that I judge my son's relationships by just a few measures, which is he happy, is he healthy, and is he writing? And the truth is, since he's met you, he hasn't been happy, he hasn't been healthy, and he hasn't been writing. So, no, I actually don't like you. And that's really sort of the reason I tell that story is because it articulates for me one of the things that has been true in a lot of parts of my life is I ask those questions. Is this thing making me happy? Is this thing making me healthy? And is this thing helping me to write? And if it's not, I've been fairly ruthless about it. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it absolutely does, and I appreciate you at least willing to go there with some of our, well, with myself and then those who will be listening, because I've got a couple friends, very close friends, one of which is the gentleman who has been on the program several times. He's a Vietnam-era vet. He's a Marine Corps vet. He's a guy that I met as soon as I got out of the Marine Corps and started doing anti-war work. He's a professor at a university that I go to. Here in Northwest Indiana. And so in a lot of ways, he started off as a mentor and has become like basically one of my best friends. And he's much older than I am. He's about 64 years old. He's about 61 years old. And for him and I mean, we can call each other, 2 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock in the morning. What's going on? Did you hear about this? Did you get this news story? He actually passed along the report that you were talking about from the intergovernment, or from the government agency, the conservative government agency that gave a 5-year warning. He sent that to me right away. But this is, I mean, I could spend all day reading, writing, talking about these things, interviewing folks and learning more knowledge, watching documentaries. And so it's difficult. I guess the reason I want to ask you just this question and ask other folks this question is because I feel like I'm going through and have been going through those processes since I've gotten home from the Marine Corps back in 2006. It's this, you know, who do I cut out of my life? Who's in my life? What, you know, advances what we're trying to do, you know, make these significant changes. I've personally ruined many holidays, since I've gotten back just, because I won't deal with the BS. I won't deal with someone, calling black people the N-word. I won't deal with someone saying that we should drop a bomb on the Middle East and turn it into a parking lot. There's a lot of things that I just simply won't deal with anymore. And so it puts you in a weird position. I mean, I'll speak for myself. It puts me in a weird position. I feel alienated. And you know, I've found good friends. I've got a lot of good friends. I must say I have a good social network and social, you know, life of friends that I love and care about a lot, many of whom I've known for years. But then in other ways, you know, I work at a neighborhood bar 2-3 nights a week. So I go from having conversations like this, to, you know, 2 nights from now on Thursday night, I'll be closing up a bar, where some people, don't even know that we're going to war in Afghanistan or that, any species are dying on a daily basis. So I've been put in this position, and it's interesting because yes, I'm with you. I would much rather be around folks where we could constantly talk about these ideas, develop actions, develop thoughts and move forward. But in another way, I also find it fortunate that I do get to talk about these things with folks. So I can go from having a conversation with someone like yourself, to 2 nights from now talking with a mill worker who just got off of a 12-hour shift, and might be a Republican. But regardless, I'm there for 6 to 8 hours. So I either have to learn to deal with it, ignore everyone or start these conversations. And I will say, you know, folks who might start off calling a black person by the N-word or referring to women in derogatory ways or could care less about the environment. I have seen people, I know, like we were talking about, there's not much time, but, you know, in 3-4 years, I've seen people significantly change, and that's no BS. I mean, people going straight from, you know, I could care less to, hey, who's this Derek Jensen guy? Or maybe you should let me borrow one of his books, or maybe you should let me borrow a Noam Chomsky book, or, you know, I mean, people making drastic changes.
I think that that's really, really important and great work. And, And I think that there are some people who are really good at it, and some people really like it. I think we all have different roles to play in that way. I think it's really important work. Sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. No, I just, see, that's interesting you say that, because the gentleman I was mentioning, Professor Sipes, or Kim is his name, he's the same way. He'll always tell me, Vince, I have no idea how you talk to these people. I have no idea how you can deal with folks saying that kind of stuff. He says exactly what you just said, which was, we all have different roles to play and we all have different talents. So, I appreciate you talking about it, Derek, and I appreciate you taking the amount of time that you've taken tonight. I really do. You answered all the questions I had mapped out for us, and I think this will be probably the best interview we've conducted so far. There's a lot of information in there and hardly anything we talked about before, so this is really great.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, your questions are great. It's fun doing interviews with you. You're great. So let's do it again sometime.